Blog Talk Radio.
The Rebecca Roth Show, where the light shines out of the darkness onto the elephant in the room.
Well, hello everybody. Welcome to the Rebecca Roth Show. I'm Ramjet, your host, and we're delighted to be with you once again. We've got what we think is an excellent show today. We're going to be talking about the phone calls on the various flights, starting with Flight 11. And we welcome and bring in Miss Rebecca Roth.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here on my show. Okay, you can still...
Each week you begin to sound better.
I sound more and more like myself.
You don't sound like you're coming out of your coffin.
Yeah, well, okay, here's what we're going to do today, and I know that this is something that people have asked me to do for about a year and a half now, so I'm sorry. I got so busy doing that second book and other things that came up, but people wanted to hear all of this, and so what I want to do with this next, probably two shows, I'm going to guess, is I want to tell you how I discovered what I did as a flight attendant of 31 plus years as I started to look at 9/11 and the phone calls that were made and the information or the details that were put in each phone call by each person. So what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to take this down as the very first phone call, on Flight 11, it was the first flight, American Airlines Flight 11, two flight attendants called out. And for when I found that, I was like, okay, well, I'm in my game now. And so let's see, what did they do? Because I know we talked about this on our last show, the common strategy, the FAA hijack protocols, and they were really set in stone. And this was something we reviewed every single year in our yearly recertification training. The code words, the step-by-step protocol, what to do. The name of the game was getting the airplane and our passengers and ourselves on the ground where the aircraft could be liberated by some team, whether that would be an FBI team, a SWAT team, Navy SEALs, and a lot of that would depend on exactly where you had been brought down and what was available on the ground. Some cities don't have, for instance, an FBI office or a hostage rescue team real close by. So maybe it would be one team at one city and a different type of team at another city. So that a lot of that depends on where you're taken. Now, of course, the strategy is to get the airplane on the ground somewhere where there is a hostage rescue team available. So, of course, that's something the air traffic controllers would have been putting into place with the logistics of where we were at the time they found out we were hijacked, okay? So, now, keep in mind Flight 11, according to the documents that we can find, and an interesting thing about 9/11 is that all the times vary. There's nothing in stone, really. The flight attendant, Betty Ong, called in, according to some documents from the United States government, at 8:18. Some of them say she called in at 8:19. Some of them say she called in at 8:20. And I think there's even one that says 8:21. So you have to see what we have to deal with. And when I found that, it was very frustrating for me because I'm a scientist in my mind. So I like things to be precise, and I know that in the airline industry, for many, many years, I was just talking to Ramjet about this the other day, before we were all computerized, we used to have to write paid sheets, and so every segment that we flew, and this was really horrible if you flew six stops in a day domestically, and you did that for 5 days in a row, because you had lots of things to add up, hours, minutes, and seconds. We were actually talking about calculators and computers and how they'd evolved over time. And I remember in Japan, when, I can't remember the company, and it was Sony or one of the regular well-known companies that was making calculators and stuff, came out with one that did hours, minutes, and seconds. And we had to have it. Man, I didn't care if it cost me a month's paycheck. I had to have one of those. Because when you're really tired and jet-lagged out and you've been flying a lot, it doesn't matter if you're domestic or international, to do math, hours, minutes, and math for, you know, X amount of segments, even sometimes 5 or 6 segments if you were flying international, you could do your math 3 or 4 times and get a different answer each time. So I was really good at math. But the calculator made it really cool, and it was about the size of an iPhone right now. So that was kind of a cool thing to have, and we all had one. Anybody that was anyone in the airline had one of those. But times have changed, and so one of the things I was looking at is how come nothing was precise? I mean, Flight 93 that supposedly crashed in Shanksville, I think there's 10 official crash times, and they even claim that they got a flight recorder off of there. So guess what? Everything's on a computer, and everything is by the minutes, and everything's by the clock. So that was one of the oddities about 9/11 I found overall, is that United States government documents, from the, whether it's the NTSB, FAA, or the FBI, were like they were dealing with 3 different, or sometimes 4 or 5 different crash scenes or cases, or incidences, I guess we could call it. So that's one of the things that I did. And so what I want to do is I really want to cover these in depth, because that's what you guys asked me to do, without anybody, without any radio host butting in, with no commercials or anything like that. If all we get to today is the first flight attendant or the first two, I'm going to keep doing these right on down the line, so I cover every detail of every phone call, because that's what I saw as a flight attendant, that something's wrong with this picture. Because the flight attendant and pilots were not following the FAA hijack protocol common strategy. And so that's what I want to help you do. Now, I'm going to have to admit this. I was going over some of these FBI documents this morning, we were talking about some of the differences, and it's very confusing. So I'm going to try to show you using an FBI document. Now, for those trolls out there that love to listen to my shows and misquote me, you're going to have to go find this document. It's a case number, FBI, 265A as in Apple, hyphen, N as in Nancy, Y as in Yankee, hyphen, 280350 hyphen, 302 hyphen, 3005. This is a FBI document. Taken in a transcript from a taped phone call from Betty Ong on 9/11/2001. So what I want to do is I want to cover the first one that I have from the FBI, because actually it's dated and time-stamped relatively. So, and then I'm going to take you to what they, how this transformed into the quote-unquote official story, if that makes sense. And what I want to do is I'll try to remember, too, to point out the details, because one of the things that I saw when I was going through all of these transcripts, written, typed out transcripts of Betty Ong's phone call, is that it changed so much. It was only a 4-minute taped call. Now, the whole thing was supposed to be recorded, but unfortunately, American Airlines had just coincidentally had their emergency line for their reservations, which is probably why Betty Ong was told to call into there, reworked by Rockwell Collins. Kind of a big part of the whole program, too. If you dig into 9/11, you're going to find them, too. They're kind of part of that ACARS company. And so everything's kind of connected in here, without getting onto a tangent about Rockwell Collins and all the relationships that I discovered. But just coincidentally, and I actually had an American Airlines reservations person tell me about that. After the upgrade, only 4 minutes or thereabouts, maybe a few seconds more, were recorded instead of the entire call. Well, that was really handy for 9/11. So we have 4 minutes of a call that's transcribed here by the FBI.
So really what you're saying is you've got 4 minutes of what was, what, a 25-minute call?
About 27 minutes.
Uh-huh. 27 minutes. So the other 23 minutes can be said whatever they want to say.
Right. And that would be kind of what happened is as soon as, well, we know this now because I've actually been in contact with American Airlines people that were working in operations. The FBI was there immediately and they shut down the entire big room of operations at American Airlines, and no one could leave. No one could come in. I mean, they were practically doing retinal eye scanning, man. They had some serious security happening right there. And so they were actually being told the story by the FBI what happened. And so when you're hearing what a ticket agent thinks she's remembering, keep in mind that the FBI had been in there, was right there on the scene immediately, telling her what she saw or heard. And so there are details that are put in here in this information that are really, really weird. And so one of the things that I want to first talk to you about here is this one transcript. It says, today's date is September 11th, 2001, and the time is 12:28 Central. This isn't the FBI document from the case study number I just gave you earlier, so you can go back if you missed it and you want to talk about it or read it or go find it online, because that's where you can find it. And Google search that number. And this is basically the FBI interviewing the reservations agent. It says Terry, North Carolina, but other documents say it's Cary with a C. So again, we've got lots for the FBI. This is people tell me I'm a good investigator. Someone even said you should have gone to work for the FBI. Well, when I see the FBI can't figure out if the town is T with a Terry or C with a Cary, as with a C in North Carolina, I have to question all their work.
You can't work for the FBI. You're CIA.
That's right. Don't tell Fetzer. Okay. So anyway, here's what I want to point out to you. When Betty Ong called reservations number one, I have been contacted by several American Airlines people. They did not have a designated reservations line for flight attendants like myself to call in if there was an emergency. Now, we talked about the common strategy. The common strategy was that we, flight attendants, spoke to the ground through the cockpit because we didn't have telephones that worked. Cell phones didn't work. Airphones rarely worked, and not all airplanes had them. So all of our communication to anyone on the ground about a hijacker, his weapons, his demands, blah, 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 would have gone through the cockpit. So on this day, unusual day that it was, we have Betty Ong calling reservations. Well, now, reservations was where I would have to call in if I were going to take my family on vacation and fly in what was called a non-rev ticket. Or it wasn't a non-revenue. There was revenue involved, and it was maybe $20, $80, $160, depending upon where in the world we went and how many of us there were. If I was to call reservations, and let's just say this, I'm going to call reservations, I'm going to take my family to Hawaii. I'm going to say when they answer the phone, when the gal answers the phone, says, hi, this is Julie at American Airlines. How can I help you? I'll say, hi, Julie. This is Rebecca Roth. I'm a flight attendant based in Boston. My employee number is 817652. Boom, she's got the number. That's my employee number. Everything is going to be based on that. And then I would also tell her my seniority number is 21-1973. And so she would have my seniority number, because when you go and you're traveling non-rev, everything goes on seniority. There's only 4 seats in first class, and you have the most seniority, you're going to get there. But here's the problem about calling into reservations during a hijacking. You could be on hold, just like any other passenger, for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, or longer sometimes. I hate to say that. But that's the way it is. It's the truth. And everybody that's ever called and made a reservation for an airline knows that you could be on hold for a long time. Well, if you're in an emergency situation like a hijacking, and somebody maybe is taking over the cockpit, or somebody's got a bomb strapped to them, or a gun, or whatever, the last place you would ever call would be somewhere where you would be on hold for a long time.
And keep in mind, too, that this was in 2001 when the Internet wasn't as heavily used as it is now. to make airplane reservations. So most people, when they did make right. reservations, used the phone centers.
Exactly.
And so the idea of being on hold really mm-hmm. was, you know, something mm-hmm. that you always had to deal with.
Exactly. And so knowing what standard protocol is, as I'm looking at this information, as I started, after I found out there were half a dozen of the hijackers were still alive, according to the BBC article, which was September 21st, I believe, 2001, that was my first discovery of, something's wrong with the 9/11 story. These hijackers are still alive. Well, how did that happen? Who was on the planes then? As I started to look and then I got into these phone calls, then I realized that this was not a hijacking at all. This was something totally different. Then as I went on, I finally eventually figured it out. So that's what I put in my first book, Methodical Illusion. And I really did take my protagonist, Vera Hansen, and bring her kind of along step by step with how I discovered this. And because all of the information that I had been either put into the 9/11 Commission, the Zachariah Massawi trial, or FBI documents that were now made available to the public. So when I look at things, and I'm going to talk to you about the phone call that Betty Ong made, and when the phone call first was recorded, the first recording, it starts out with Betty Ong saying, "This is Ong." That's her name. "We can't breathe. He's got mace or something." The ticket agent, according to the very first FBI transcript, says, "Can you describe the person that you said went into the flight deck?" Well, she never said that. Betty Ong had just said, "This is Ong. We can't breathe. He's got mace or something." So where did the ticket agent come up with somebody being in the flight deck? Which is, by the way, another word for cockpit. And at one point, people started to get, this is really crazy, but I'm going to tell you it's an inside thing, and I know it happened at every airline. We used to always call the front of the aircraft the cockpit. But then somebody decided that cock was a bad word, so we had to call it a flight deck. And so you see Betty Ong, she uses the term cockpit in her talking to the ticket agents. And the ticket agent just used flight deck. But nobody told the ticket agent that anyone was in the flight deck. Betty Ong then goes on to say, I'm sitting in the back, coming back from business. Can you hold a second? He's coming back. He, as in the same guy, the he that's got mace or something? So you see, I started to see that because this was removed from some of the transcripts, that she's indicating there's one hijacker and he's a he. And it's right here. Now, for those trolls that are listening, I want to tell you another thing. You want to look up this case number, 265A as in Apple, hyphen, N as in Nancy, Y as in Yankee, hyphen, 280350, hyphen, 302, hyphen, 3005. That's an FBI case number for you. That's what I'm reading to you right now. So one of the things I saw right away was Ong says, Betty, Ong, doesn't say her name is Betty. She says, "I'm Ong." Well, if somebody said that to me, I wouldn't know what that was. And so she never gives her employee number, it's often referred to as a clock number, or her seniority number. She's talking to the reservation agent who is not trained to be part of a hijacking situation. She's calling into a number. She's confusing the heck out of reservations, gal. And so the reservations, now this goes on to say there's some unintelligible noise in the background after Betty said he's coming back. Then she says, our number one, and then she stops and says, he stood upstairs. Nobody knows what he's going to do. As in, again, one hijacker who's a he. We can't get to the cockpit. The door won't open. Hello, she says to the ticket agent who's on the phone. And the ticket agent comes back and she says, can you, something unintelligible, information relative to, force that. At this point, what operation, what flight are you talking about? Flight 12? I don't know how she got that. According to this document, this is a transcript from a tape recording, and nobody said anything yet about Flight 12. So I don't know where the ticket agent came up with this, because she didn't have a clock number or an employee number to find Betty Ong in a computer, and we had a computer system. She could have done that, just flipped right over to another system off her reservations line. And then when she says he stood upstairs, I thought, well, that's an interesting thing for her to say. There's no stairs on the 767. And I know this is one of the things that trolls. I saw somebody trolled a YouTube against me on this because they can't find this. But that's why I gave you the document twice. It's an FBI case number. You can find this. You can see it right here. I can tell you what page it is so I could see it. Page 3. And she said, he stood upstairs. And when I saw that, I realized that there's only stairs in a hangar. There's no stairs on the 767. The only aircraft that has stairs is a 747. And so it goes on to say, when the gal asked her, what flight are you on? Flight 12. She says, right now, okay, we're on flight 11 right now. But somehow, earlier in another transcript, Betty claimed right away that she was on Flight 12, which is her return flight.
Now, that's my question, really, about Flight 12. Wouldn't Flight 12, scheduled for 9/11, be leaving from Los Angeles, going back to Boston later in the day?
That's correct.
So maybe like 2 or 3 hours from
mm-hmm.
that point?
Yeah.
So wouldn't a reservation agent or whoever it is know that that flight wasn't even
in the air yet?
In the air yet?
That's correct. And that's, and we're talking about that when we talk about Amy Sweeney, because Amy Sweeney did the same thing. Now, here in this particular transcript, Betty Ong says Flight 11, but I've got other ones. There are other ones where she first tells the ticket agent she's on Flight 12. And I know that's troubled a lot of people because they didn't understand why would she do that. But that's the way the flight pattern worked. And we would fly Flight 11 to L.A., lay over, and the next day fly Flight 12 back home. That was a trip. That was a two-day trip, across, transcontinental trip. And so she's in her mind, she's already landed, and she's on Flight 12. Hello, think about what I just said to you. Both flight attendants that were asked to make phone calls by the perpetrators said the same thing. They said they were on Flight 12. Flight 12 would be the flight after Flight 11 lands. They lay over and they take off the next day. So do you think Flight 11 might have landed somewhere and it caused that confusion in their minds? And it's really easy for flight attendants to do that if you've already landed, because now your next working trip would be Flight 12. So as a flight attendant, I see this. And when another thing that Betty Ong then she says to the ticket agent that she called, she says, we're working on. And the agent said, yeah. She said, one of the flight attendants has been stabbed. And the ticket agent asked her, can anybody get into the cockpit? She asked her that twice. But you remember that Betty Ong's kind of already said here, we can't get into the cockpit. The door won't open. So why would the ticket agent ask her that again? That's kind of odd to me. And so Betty then says, we can't even get a manager to the cockpit. We don't know what's going on up there. And the agent then tells her, well, keep the door closed. The cockpit door, okay, well, that's, of course, something would happen. And then there's another thing here where an agent says, and this is just in one of the initial transcripts. So these are the things I started to look for because I found out after I reading 3 or 4 of these that it had been manipulated, and the tape recording you hear on YouTube, totally manipulated. So the agent asks, did you see the girl who got stabbed? Keep in mind that Betty Ong, working the very back of the aircraft at 3R, is about 159 feet away from the cockpit door and first class, or the girl who got stabbed. Now, Betty Ong never really said that she was a girl, and there were male flight attendants on board as well. So I found that was kind of an interesting thing that the agent would say that, because it doesn't seem like she's got any of that information. And then Betty Ong, according to this transcript, says, I think the guys are up there. Well, the guys are what we always refer to as the pilots. And so if we were in a crew bus or ready to go, let's say from the hotel to the airplane, the whole crew, but the pilots weren't there, we would say, the guys aren't here yet. So that terminology, I think the guys are up there, to me reads that she thinks that her pilots are up there. And then she goes, oh, go ahead.
Well, I mean, that's interesting, because if the plane had landed in Westover, as you have mm-hmm. described, and the pilots may have gotten off, then mm-hmm. she's not sure whether the guys are up there or not.
Mm-hmm.
If the plane is in the air, where else are the guys going to be?
Exactly.
And she says, I think the guys are uh-huh. here. So it's an incongruency.
Yep. Another one.
That raises mm-hmm. a red flag.
Yep. And then Betty Ong goes on to say, they might have gone. They're on their way up there or something. They might have gone where? Into the hangar. Upstairs, maybe. Okay, because they sure as heck aren't getting off the airplane if it's at 29 or 39,000 feet. So then she goes on to say, nobody can call the cockpit to see if we can get inside. Hey, is anybody still there? She's asking, is the reservations people still in line? The reservations answers and says, yes, I'm still here. Betty Ong says, okay, I'm staying on the line as well. A flight attendant on any kind of a phone device in a hijacking? Wrong. First off, you wouldn't do it. You're told not to do it because you want to sit down and not draw attention to yourself. No flight attendant would ever be sitting on a telephone for 27 minutes in a real hijacking with hijackers on board. Or a hijacker. It doesn't matter how many there. One or six. It doesn't matter. Having a telephone to your ear would be a surefire way to meet the weapon they were packing. Trust me, and a great way to end your life, and a great way for a gun to go off if you were in the air inside your cabin, and possibly causing a decompression and a crash landing. So not the right thing to do. So as I'm looking through this stuff, and I'm really interested in why would Betty Ong say this stuff, but here's another thing that's really interesting. They bring in another reservations person who comes in now to join the phone call with Betty and the other reservations person and says, who's calling reservations? Is this a flight attendant or who? Because this person's getting a weird phone call and they don't know who it is. And Betty Ong then tells this other reservation agent, I'm number three. I'm number three on this flight. That means she's third in seniority. I'm number three on this flight, and on this flight, in flight 11, have you guys called anyone else? You know, somebody's calling medical, and we can't get them. Now, the tape ends here, according to one FBI story. But according to this transcript I have, it does not end here, okay? There is an unidentified male voice that says something. Someone says, is anybody there? Is anybody there? And then the reservation person says to Betty Ong, what seat are you in? What seat are you in? Betty Ong answers that question by saying, we just left Boston and we're up in the air. We're supposed to go to LA. Well, if you were in the air and you were on flight 11, you wouldn't say supposed to. You would say, we are going to Los Angeles, if you said anything. But that supposed to told me that they weren't in the air anymore, to me.
Well, yeah. She's, if we just left Boston and we're up in the air, where else would you be?
Right. And then another thing that I found, and I've talked about this, and a lot of people ask me, did you think these calls were scripted? In a sense, I think they were. They may not have had cards with things written on it. They may have just been told, okay, here's the scenario. And you're going to make this phone call and you make sure they believe you're up in the air. Because as we get back down to Flight 93, you're going to see where that really comes into play and how many people ended up saying this. And let me just tell you from a flight attendant's viewpoint, a hijacking, which, by the way, Betty hasn't mentioned yet, A hijacking only takes place in the air, and if a violent person, hijacker, or terrorist were to get on an aircraft while you were on the ground with passengers, you would just arm your chute, open the door, blow the chute, and tell everybody, come this way and get off the plane. And then he'd be standing there with an airplane with the nobody there. And so the hostage rescue people would come and take him, or the police or FBI. So these are the things I'm looking at. So after she says, we're up in the air, and we just left Boston, we're up in the air, we're supposed to go to L.A., the agent asks her this, what seat number are you? What is the number of your seat? And Betty Ong says, I'm in the jump seat right now at 3R. That's the very aft jump seat on the right side of the aircraft in the tail. Okay, are you a flight attendant? I'm sorry. Why was she saying this? Are you a flight attendant? She asked her twice. Because she's a reservation agent. And a reservation agent would know that a flight attendant would not call in the middle of a hijacking to reservations. So there's confusion there. And then there's three layers of reservations people. And then they bring in the security people into this phone call. Can you see how confusing this is? This is why we would call directly to someone who could directly connect us without all of these other people involved and having to repeat herself. And so Betty Ong then says, hello, hello. And then they say, what is your name? Remember, she started out with, this is Ong. Okay. Well, so you'll have to speak up, Betty says. I can't hear you. All of a sudden, we're about 2 minutes into this call, and she can't hear. And so the ticket agent says to her, well, what's your name? And Betty Ong says, Betty Ong, I'm number 3 on this flight. Betty Ong again failed to give her employee number or her seniority number, but she gave a bid position that she would work that flight as the number 3 position, according to the seniority, and her preference of working that position. That is not anything of interest to anyone, especially in a hijacking. Where she's sitting in her jump seat for her bid position to work that leg of the trip is not important. And when I saw that she kept repeating this, I was like, wait a minute. It's like she doesn't know what to say. And this is protocol, man. You know what to say. We're trained every year. We in our hijack module for our yearly training, we go over exactly what to say. And so Betty Ong then goes on to say, the cockpit is not answering their calls. And there's somebody back in business class. We can't breathe in business class. Somebody's got mace or something. Now the he turned to somebody. Earlier she said he's coming back. He has sprayed mace or something. And so now she's very confused. And then the agent says, can you describe the person that you said someone is flying in business class? What does that even mean? What kind of question is that? Can you describe the person that you said someone is flying in business class?
Well, you know, I've heard you on other interviews, and it's probably a good thing to mention right here, is if you couldn't breathe in business class, but you could breathe at the back of the plane, and obviously she's not gagging, choking, or coughing, mm-hmm. then that plane's...
not pressurized.
Not pressurized, which means...
It's not in the air.
Not in the air.
It's on the ground, and that's exactly right. And when she started talking about this, and this is the second time she's mentioned the mace here with this conversation... she says again, I'm sitting in the back. Again, it's 159 feet from the cockpit. He's coming back from business class. If you can hold on, he's coming back. Now, this is really weird because the way this reads in order, pages 1 through I'm on page 5 right now, according to some of the transcripts, it's really scrambled. So I can't tell you if this was what you heard on the tape that the FBI transcript was, or if they just wanted to simplify it, or there were things they took out. They changed the he to somebody, and they took he stood upstairs completely out of other transcripts that are typed up. And so Betty Ong goes on to say, our number one, which would be the purser, senior flight attendant, our number one, who some unintelligible word stabbed, or something stabbed. Nobody knows who stabbed who, and we can't even get into business class because nobody can breathe. Our number one in stabbed right now. Our number five, the first class passenger, that our first class galley flight attendant, and our passenger is stabbed. We can't get to the cockpit because we can't breathe. The door won't open. If you can't get to the cockpit, how do you know the door won't open? You have to get through business class, through the mace or something, to get through business class, to get to the door, to turn the doorknob and put your key in there. How would you know the door won't open? This, to a flight attendant, makes no sense at all. I already know I'm going to be notified by my friends from American Airlines on this, because we've kind of gone over this on the side. The fact that she never gave her employee number or seniority number or any identifying information in an event as important and as horrific as a hijacking.
Now, according to the official story, how many hijackers were on Flight 11? Five?
Oh, good question, because Amy Sweeney, I believe, said three. Betty Ong never gives a number officially in the FBI transcripts.
Well,
she never says that anybody but the guys, who we refer to the pilots as, are in the cockpit.
Well, according to the official story, the hijackers get into the cockpit, but they don't all go into the cockpit. So there's obviously somebody there that is going to prevent people from getting to the cockpit door to try and open it.
Yeah, but that's not what Betty says.
Well, exactly.
There you go. See,
and
when
so
you start to look at it like that,
it conflicts with the official story.
Exactly. And I think the official story says there were four or five hijackers on each plane. I think Amy Sweeney, if I remember correctly, she says there were three, but Betty Ong never gives a number here in the FBI documents, in the transcripts from the 4 minutes of the tape recording. Now, remember when we talked about the Common Strategy FAA hijacking protocol, and I said to you, if you heard this one, I'm going to repeat it again. If I were on the phone for 4 minutes, the very first and most important thing for me as a flight attendant to say to the company, to anybody that had ears to hear, to give this to the right people, to the FAA, to who would make changes, is how someone got into the cockpit. But Betty Ong never says anyone that's a hijacker is in the cockpit. That comes later with Amy Sweeney. But that would be the most important thing, not what jump seat I'm sitting at, not what I had for my crew breakfast or what's going on. And again, also keep in mind that on a 767 wide body aircraft going transcontinental from Boston to Los Angeles, pretty full of fuel, you're going to be under the 10,000 foot level, which is nobody's going to get out of an airplane when we reach cruising altitude is usually around 29 to 32,000 feet. And at that time, we get up. So that takes 15 plus, somewhere between usually 15 and 20 minutes, depending upon your traffic. Some airports have noise abatement, this, that, and the other thing, and traffic, air traffic. If you have to deviate around, somebody else is coming in, or there's emergencies or whatever. So, when I saw that it was 18 minutes into her flight, I was like, well, there's no reason that the girl working the back galley or the back end of coach would be calling the cockpit for any reason anyway. So when she's saying that the cockpit won't answer her calls, I need to know why would she, as the galley person, be calling, because the flight attendants up front would be dealing with the pilots. And the only reason that I could think of that she would be saying that she couldn't talk to the cockpit. Now, keep in mind, she says this right away, 18 minutes after departure. Well, that means she's already been trying to call and they're not answering. She's probably called three or four, maybe five times. So when she calls reservations and tells reservations she can't get the pilots to answer the phone, I'm thinking, well, she's probably been trying to call for at least 5 minutes or longer. Why would she call when you're on a climb out? You're in what's called a sterile cockpit. And we can't call the cockpit unless there's an emergency on board the aircraft and we need to land. The airplane's on fire. There's something going on in the cabin. We've got CPR in progress. There's something that really is a serious emergency. It's the only reason we can call and break what's called sterile cockpit. And that is when the aircraft is below 10,000 feet. So when I'm putting the times together, I'm looking at 13 minutes after takeoff. Man, they're barely out of sterile cockpit. There's no reason that the gal working the back end of the aircraft would be calling the cockpit unless this scenario wasn't really what we were told was happening. The aircraft had landed, which it had, we know that now, and they were just playing a game. It was like a charade. They were just maybe I'm thinking that the perpetrators, the handlers on board, told the flight crews so that we wouldn't fight back that this was part of a drill, either for the military or the FAA or both, and that they were going to be brought into an office and they were going to be told to tell the person they call that they were hijacked, because the people who were telling them that and were probably standing them over them with a pistol didn't know our code words. They didn't know our protocols, and so that's why none of the flight attendants were doing the right thing, especially when we get to the later flights when they called their parents or their spouse.
Well, you know, it sounds to me as you're reading through this that, you know, Betty Ong was given a scenario that she was supposed to portray to the reservations agents, and she kind of screwed it up. Mm-hmm. Either because she was nervous or on purpose. It's hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
But Betty Sweeney was then used to kind of, you know, smooth over the rough spots in Betty Ong's story. So it's kind of interesting.
Well, and let's see how much time we have here. I want to talk a little bit about that. So you see, as a flight attendant, when I started to go through these phone calls, I have another transcript on Betty Ong, but that's only why I have this out here, is that this one is dated September 12, 2001, and it starts out not where Betty Ong was saying, "I'm Ong," or "This is Ong." She says, "I'm number three in the back. The cockpit's not answering. Somebody's stabbed in business class, and I think there's mace, and we can't breathe. I don't know. I think we're getting hijacked." Well, that's not at all what the transcript from 9/11 on the first interview on 9/11/2001 said. No, nowhere is that. So this is a complete made-up story by the FBI.
So this is 24 hours later.
Exactly.
That they've had a chance to take what she said on the actual transcript and decide what they really wanted her to say, because she kind of flubbed it up the first time.
Exactly. Now, here in this one that's typed out in a lot different manner, she doesn't say in here, "He's got pepper spray." She says, "Somebody's stabbed in business class. Somebody's got pepper spray." Again, she gives no employee number, no seniority number. And again, her complaint is the cockpit's not answering their phone. And again, there's no reason for her to be phoning them unless, I mean, there just isn't. Unless, if she were really in the air, I would say they'd started to descend. Other than that.
Now, my favorite part on that is when she says, "I think we're being hijacked."
Yeah, well, when you're being hijacked, there's no thinking. You know it. For her to say, "I don't know, but I think we might be being hijacked." Now, this is in the second transcript from the FBI that's retyped. This is not from the one that they claimed.
It's almost like they put that in there, that she didn't really say that, but
they
wanted
it.
The story mm-hmm. to be the story, and so they put in there, "I think we're being hijacked," which
Exactly. Well, here's it. I mean, when I go through and I'm looking and I use the Terror Timeline or History Commons a lot to compare things, and the story's very, very different. And keep in mind that on the 27-minute phone call, that this aircraft went from 39,000 feet, almost 40,000 feet, down to less than 1,000 feet when it hit the building, supposedly.
Yeah, now this is on the official story.
Well, yeah. The official story claiming that if this is what they're claiming the airplane did, it was going from western Massachusetts up to Albany, New York, and then turned down south and crashed into the tower. Well, it crashed in roughly 1,000 feet or 700 feet or something, whatever the elevation was on the floor that it crashed into. Point being, it went from 40,000 feet nearly down to roughly 1,000 feet. Two flight attendants are on the phone, and neither really one of them says anything about a descent. Well, I would think that a flight attendant could feel it, because we can. We know when the airplane starts descending, you can hear it. So, now the DC-10 used to come out like we called it a whale. It sounded like it was breathing, and once we would start the process of descending, the aircraft makes different noises. And when flaps are coming down, or landing gear is coming down, or just the engines aren't revved as high or whatever. So there was nothing like that. So here's the thing that really troubled me about that. Now, I don't have an FBI document on Amy Sweeney in front of me, but I do have quotes from the History Commons webpage and what these are FBI quotes. But the thing that really bothered me is that Amy Sweeney, she calls in and she originally tells, and this has changed too throughout the different government documents. She originally called in and said that the hijacker, again, one man, was seated in 9B. She calls back. She actually made, I believe, four phone calls to her supervisor in Boston Logan Airport. And then she calls back and says, oh, I made a mistake. No, the hijacker is in 10B. And it was 9B who was stabbed. And then I'm telling you right here and now that if a flight attendant were able to make a call to her boss at the airport, you would never make a mistake of tagging the wrong seat number or the wrong passenger as a hijacker, because there's about a 99.99% chance that you would never get a chance to make another phone call, connect again, because she'd already tried to call and it wasn't connecting. Things weren't happening for her. And she was calling, and she first started talking to a secretary. She did the same thing. She said flight 12. Well, flight 12 was going to come in later on at like gate 32. So her supervisor heads out to where he thinks flight 12 is, because at that time there was a lot of air rage and he thought they were on the ground and somebody was refusing to get off the plane or decided they were, you know, drunk and whatever. So when Amy Sweeney gets connected finally to her supervisor, she tells him that Betty Ong, who said she was seated at the jump seat on the 3R jump seat, is seated next to her, and they're in the second to the last row in coach. Which is it? See, because here's the important thing. If you're telling somebody on the ground you're seated in your jump seat at 3R, jump seats fold down. They fold down, and so that when the door opens, a lot of the doors pop inward. And if you're sitting there, it's a great way to get your knees busted. Or if a SWAT team comes in, you don't want to be in their way, because they're gonna open that door. They're gonna come in and open the door, because they would coordinate everything with the pilots, and the pilots would say to the flight attendant at 3R, disarm your chute. Once we're on the ground, disarm your chute, because they're gonna come in your door. And so,
but wasn't there also another issue in that particular scenario? Because if Betty Ong was seated in the jump seat at 3R and she was on an airphone, didn't your American Airlines tell you that the airphone wouldn't reach to the jump seat?
That's correct.
And so this was an example of Sweeney trying to cover up and...
Exactly.
You know, help Betty Young's story facilitate all the way through to the end, because now she's sitting in the second row where the airphone she could be talking on.
Exactly. And so, and that's a great point. So another thing that that's very interesting about this is that, remember, at the very end of the phone call for Betty Ong, she said they were trying to call medical. They were making a PA announcement. And also, Betty Ong does say, eventually, according to the ticket agent, that all of the first-class passengers were moved to coach. Betty Ong is on the phone to her supervisor saying that none of the coach passengers are aware of anything other than a medical emergency because they've paged for a doctor or an EMT or a nurse.
Well, wouldn't the first class passengers who were moved back to coach also have trouble getting through business class with the maze?
Yeah, they were up there breathing it, weren't they, for quite a long time, because Betty never tells us they were moved. And Amy never says they were moved. Everybody just thinks everything's just normal, everything's cool. And so when I started to see these really mixed signals, and one of the most important things, according to the common strategy, is that we had everything the same. If we had time, we would even have synced our watches, because the pilots are going to be told by the SWAT team, we're coming in at 1,300 hours, exactly. Synchronize your watch. I'm not kidding you. And so if that were the case, we would have. So it's very important that you are giving the same story. But here's another thing. Amy Sweeney, not only does she say things are not quite right, but she also says that they have a bomb. She says they have a bomb on board. So she says there's three hijackers and they have a bomb.
Did they pack that themselves? Or the did bomb? They? Or was it out of their sight?
Well, yeah, exactly. That was the security questions at the time. So Betty Ong says there's two hijackers. Amy Sweeney says there's three. And then Betty Ong says this only after 9/12. It's not in any FBI document. She never says what seat number in any FBI document transcripts I have about her. That's all added later. Now, one of the things that I found was really kind of concerning is that Betty said they were calling for a doctor, but there was nobody to tend to these people that were stabbed. Keep in mind now, this is at the fourth minute of her phone call. But Amy Sweeney says there's a doctor and a nurse on board tending to them. Which is it? And that's just not going to happen in a real life emergency. And so that told me that both Betty Ong and Amy Sweeney were more than likely in two different offices upstairs in the hangar, probably on a landline, because they were both on the phone for nearly 27 minutes until the supposed crash happened. Betty Ong got off around 2 minutes prior. And now, again, let me just say this. If a flight attendant that's been flying 3 years, but I think Amy Sweeney was 13 years seniority or thereabouts, maybe more, can't remember all the details about all of them. But at the very end, someone says to her, can you tell where you're at or what's your location? She says, I see buildings. I see water. And then, boom, at the very end of the call, supposedly, the plane supposedly hits. Any flight attendant that is near 1,000 feet above the ground, that has come from 29 or 30,000 feet or 19,000 feet and descended into Manhattan and is approaching the World Trade Center towers and is looking out to the Hudson River on her right, Manhattan on her left, is not going to say, I see water, I see buildings. We're way too low. She's going to say, we're over Manhattan, period. And every flight attendant you talk to will tell you the same thing. You fly into Manhattan, whether it's Newark, across the river, just across the river from the towers, because at the end of the runway, you're just right across the river from where the towers were. You could see them very clearly. You were in LaGuardia, which was just a little bit off toward the east and the north of where she would have seen LaGuardia Airport, too. She looked out the window. And JFK, which is just a little bit further south. And you could probably see Teterboro, too. And so It's a very familiar sight, and there is no place like New York, New York. I even made a song about it. Okay? So there's no place like New York. Any flight attendant, even if you've flown in there one time, he'd been flying 30 days, would look out the window and say to her supervisor, "We're over Manhattan. We're over New York City." And she didn't. And that was a huge clue to me that she didn't know where she was supposed to be in the scenario. And so that's when I really realized that, uh-oh, Spaghetti-O, this is not a hijacking. This airplane isn't anywhere near New York City. Surely Amy Sweeney would have recognized what she was looking at out the window. Okay? So then when I got there, that's when my stomach started to turn. Because then I realized that there's a reason they didn't follow hijack protocol. And you know, the flight attendants, they all eight of them were military trained. Pretty tough guys, too, from I've talked to lots of people that flew with all of them.
You're talking about the pilots.
Pilots.
The guys.
The guys. None of the pilots ever squawked the hijack code 7500. None of them fought back when an intruder came into the cockpit when we have an incredible weapon right there that could kill anybody that goes into the cockpit. It's impossible. The scenario at that point is truly impossible. So I guess we're kind of running out of time. But I think you understand, as a flight attendant, as a trained flight attendant, what a flight attendant would see when you start looking. And one of the things I found was very interesting is that the FBI documents changed. So I had to go in. Literally, I was circling things like, he stood upstairs. Why would they take that out? Well, because there are no stairs on the airplane, maybe. But maybe because someone like me would have seen it. I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. I just know that it was changed. Lots of stuff were deleted. He became a somebody. It's just really interesting. And then, of course, you've got your YouTube where people have edited things in and out. So what I'd like to do is continue on the next show we do with the phone calls from the next flights, because 175 would be the next flight and two passengers called in. Very interesting. History's very interesting details. And then Flight 77 with Barbara Olson and a flight attendant, one of each, a flight attendant, crew member, and a passenger. And then Flight 93. So it may take me a few shows to do this, but I want you to understand what I was seeing, what should have been going on when I saw things like, I think we might be hijacked, we're in the air. That's a redundancy a flight attendant wouldn't say. And in a hijacking, you would be speaking pretty much your commands, and you would be giving that information that was so important for the FAA to know and for the flight attendants and for the future of everyone flying. They got into the cockpit by, one, fill in the blank, whatever it was. How did they get into the cockpit was the most important thing, and no one ever said that day, and there were almost 30 flight attendants. No one ever said that. And how did they get in there? So we know also that United and American also had the flight termination system. American called theirs the flight interruption system, the remote control system. And we also know that when that's kicked in, they can't talk to anybody, not even the flight attendants in the back, so they weren't hearing their phone ring. They weren't able to talk to anyone, including the flight attendants. And when I saw Betty Ong say that, I went, uh-oh, this sounds like a remote control system's taken over the cockpit. And that's really when my stomach sunk down. So we're going to take that one by one and one. And if you have any questions, if you want me to cover something a little bit better, you can just send me an email. At the end of this, you'll see in the description box, there'll be the where you can find my emails. You can ask me on Facebook and my author page, my like page, or my group, or my personal Facebook, whatever. And just ask me if there's something I haven't explained. This we'll call this one Flight 11 phone calls. And if there's something that we need to fill in later, we'll sure do that. And I may just remember some of this stuff. So.
Well, Rebecca, well, I think that was a great show.
Out a glass of water.
We're always grateful when you just let your mind roll and tell us the things that have been important to you and that have brought your research to fruition in writing the books. If you want to know more about this, you can read her books, Methodical Illusion, Methodical Deception. This particular show really goes further in depth than the books do, and we will continue to do that. But it's been an awesome time. Thank you. We'll see you again next week.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us.